welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, I like to think of Garden Talk as your weekly resource for all things gardening. What about that? We've got plenty to talk about today on the show. For example, Bruce Bagenberg is back with us. He's the statewide horticulture outreach specialist, resides in the horticulture program of UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He also writes a weekly gardening column. It's called Wisconsin Yard and Garden, and I look through it all the time, and it's a good column to read every week. We'll talk to him about how to get the most out of your gardening catalogs. We'll take your other gardening questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. Maybe you got a question about catalogs, or maybe just something happening in your own garden or landscape. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bruce Bagenberg, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Morning, Larry. Yeah, great to be back.
Many of us are getting gardening catalogs in the mail about now. Have you gotten any?
No.
You know, I was thinking about this morning. I can think back, 20 years. Holy cow. My mailbox would be...
Yeah, I think more has come and gone to the online format now. Yeah, you're right. It used to be right after the first of the year. Yeah, the mailbox was full.
Yeah, it's changed a bit. Do you have some favorites? Of course, you can view them online, but...
I stick a lot of to the traditional ones, especially with vegetables. I like to look at, different varieties with, what's coming up. But a lot of times you look at the new ones, but you end up with the old standbys anyways. But it's always nice to look.
Yeah, it's always fun to look. I like the Baker Creek catalog, the big one. They have two. One's free. It's about 150 pages or so. And their whole seed catalog, that's always around 500 pages. And I think that sells for $15.
Yeah, I mean, some of those get to be like reference books, as you look at them.
Well, they're a lot of fun. Should we be ordering now?
Yeah, I mean, you can order, especially seeds. Certainly you can. Obviously, it's a little too early to be starting them indoors, even in the southern part of the state, but it's never too early to think about it. But that's one of the points I made when I did that column is, you've got some time in it's always great to look at what's available and look at new things and that, but do your homework. You got plenty of time and then place the order rather than, feel rushed and place the order and then find out, I really don't need this or I need some different stuff or, whatever it might be. Think it over. We're only in the first part here, January.
Yeah. Scientific names, what's a good reference? I mean, they come up a lot and people never want, well, most people, I should say, don't want to use those names.
Correct. I think,
myself
again,
included.
Yeah. The challenge not only to pronounce them, but to spell them. Spell check doesn't like them on your computer either. It's kind of, if you look at where its highest priority would be with woody ornamentals and herbaceous plants, because there's a lot of confusion. When you're dealing with fruit crops and vegetables, you really don't need it. I mean, you're looking at tomato, watermelon, whatever it is. But cultivars become more important, when you're looking at vegetable crops. But a really good example I always use when dealing with Latin names or scientific names, botanical names, it all refers to the same thing. When I used to teach the tree and shrub class, we'd always look at the example of maple. Acer is the genus of maple. And the common example, there's so much misidentification, is with the Crimson King Norway maples, which have the maroon, reddish, purplish maroon. There's some other ones. There's Crimson Queen. There's some other ones there. But on the, typically if someone sees that tree, they see the maroon foliage during the summer and they call it a red maple. A Norway maple and red maple are entirely, two entirely different species that are much different. Red maple is a native tree that's somewhat finicky and where you put it, likes acidic soil. Norway maple is not native. It's kind of become naturalized in areas, but it's much more durable and adaptable. But they're two entirely different trees. So if you went to the nursery thinking, I want a red maple because I saw one down the street, they're going to put you on an entirely different tree than you were thinking. But if you went with the botanical name, you know, Acer rubrum is red maple. Acer platinodes is Norway maple. Then you get into the nomenclature. And the key part with that Norway maple is the cultivar, Crimson King, is that maroon one that you're looking at. The species Norway maple is just a green tree. There's nothing special about it.
Yeah. You mentioned cultivars a couple of times. I got into a discussion with a friend about varieties and cultivars because he was calling a variety or a cultivar a variety. And I've actually, it's interesting. Talk about that, the difference between a cultivar and a variety.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I mean, in reality, you know, when you're dealing with catalogs, it's not that big of a deal. But technically, they are different. A variety is a natural variation of a species. So essentially, it'd be a plant that was discovered. And you see a lot of that with ornamental plants. Cultivar is essentially man-made through crop breeding. So think of cultivar as cultivated. Think of variety as a variant. You're talking about the same thing. You're talking about something that's different within a species. It's not enough difference to make it a new species, but it can be very significant. You know, we deal with landscape plants. It could be the size of the plant, the color of the flower. With vegetables, it can be one of the big things that I always stress is disease resistance. It could also be the flavor. It could be the size. You know, tomatoes are a good example. You have, you know, the big tomatoes. You have the small patio tomatoes. Those are all different cultivars in most cases. So, yeah. But yeah, technically they're different, but in reality, people interchange them, you know, and a lot of times variety kind of overrules cultivar when in discussion. Technically they're different.
Yeah. Well, that conversation got me going down the rabbit hole a little bit. And we'd been talking about apple trees. Mm-hmm. And Macintosh apples came up in the discussion. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to look up Macintosh apples history. And a guy by the name of John Macintosh, Canadian guy, you probably know this already, discovered this tree. And he really liked the apples that it produced. And so, of course, it's John Macintosh, so he named it the Macintosh. Mm-hmm. And he and his wife started grafting back around 1820 or so, and grafting the tree and selling it. And if you think about it, if you have a Macintosh tree or any other cultivar, you have... Well, with a Macintosh case, you have basically John Macintosh's tree. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a one of the readings I saw. It's like a living museum that you have in your property, be it a Macintosh or any other kind of tree, or even and of course vegetables, same kind of the same way.
Yeah, and that's, you know, gets into the genetics. But yeah, when you deal with grafting or cuttings that are taken with trees, including fruit trees and ornamental plants, trees and shrubs, you're right. Essentially, you have clones that continually go along and there's no genetic change at all. So in theory, you're looking at a plant that, you know, 100, 200 years ago, somebody might have had, and you have it in your backyard. It's technically the same genetics that you had. Yeah, and then you get into the other thing, and we used to always do this in some of our classes too, where you talk about, now what happens if I take the seed off of that tree, out of that apple? Now what happened? Well, now you got a whole different ballgame because something else came in and pollinated it, and you have no idea what you might get. If you did take that seed and then grew it out as a tree, then you create something new. But
yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah,
it is. It is. And there again, with varieties, a lot of times you assume, well, if it's Macintosh, you're assuming that that person, you know, made some kind of a cross way back when, but in reality, they may have discovered that plant and then they just continually vegetative propagation. You continue to keep those genetics and now you give it a different name. And a lot of times it is the name of the person that discovered it.
And you wind up with, in other cases, you wind up with somebody that's crossing trees or plants for, you know, various characteristics.
Yeah, and that's in particular with vegetable crops, both for home gardens and commercially. I mean, now you're looking at certain characteristics, and this brings up debates when you get into heirloom vegetables. People say, well, you know, why I don't want to change the genetics of this tomato that we've grown for generations, but from a commercial standpoint, it may have really good flavor, but it's also extremely susceptible to disease. So now you make a cross with something else to bring in the disease resistance. And then the argument is, have you lost the flavor? You know, whatever that trait might have been. So one of the ways around that, you can actually graft tomato plants. You can keep the old heirloom variety, the fruit that you like, but it's really disease susceptible, graft it onto a disease-resistant rootstock. Because technically, when you graft a plant, you've not changed its identity. You've got technically two plants, the rootstock and the scion. It's a little more involved with tomatoes. It's pretty tedious, but it can be done. And it brings, you know, a lot of discussion. And you can, like I say, you can go back and forth and talk about different things with people and test their knowledge botanically, what's going on. But, you know, a lot of things are, you know, really interesting if you really follow what's going on. But technically, when you graft a plant, you technically have two different plants as one. So
yeah, you do indeed. And when you get this, I'm thinking of seeds now, like from a seed catalog. A lot of times you'll see something like VF on the packet itself, and that means that it's resistant to, I think, Butycerium and Verticillium and Fusarium. Mm-hmm. So that's
correct.
The VF.
Yeah, and that's another thing that I know I stressed in that column, and I've done this for years when I talked about, you know, disease control. One of your best tools, especially for vegetable crops, and when you have certain diseases like Verticillium you mentioned, Fusarium you mentioned, those are both fungi that are in the soil. There's not much you can do with those. You know, there aren't sprays or anything like that. But if you have a plant that has genetic resistance, it's not immune to the disease, but it can still produce a crop if that disease is present. And that's always the best example is tomatoes. You know, when you're looking at disease resistance, look for VF, which stands for Verticillium Fusarium. You may also see N, which stands for root.nematode, which is another problem in the soil that's very difficult to control, but if you have a resistant plant. So ideally with a tomato, you pick out a VFN, you've got resistance to three major problems that are in the soil. You haven't even planted it yet, but you've taken steps to prevent the problem from occurring.
Yeah. Bruce Bangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Questions for him? We went down the rabbit hole a little bit on a couple of things relating to catalogs and cultivars versus varieties. And I always find that interesting. You may have something of a more practical nature relating to your own garden, and aside from it, whether it's a variety or a cultivar, and you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Coming up at noon today, DNR Forest Health Specialist Paul Segan is back with us to talk about protecting your trees from winter weather. So that's coming up in our second segment of the show today. Right now, we're visiting with Bruce Spangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. And we're talking about garden catalogs, protecting your plants. We're talking about any question you may have actually relating to the garden. And again, join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We are, it's got a call coming up from Minocqua. We'll get to that in just a minute here. How can you make sure a plant will do well in your landscape?
Start out with, you know, what the fundamentals, sun versus shade. You know, if you're looking at shrubs, herbaceous plants, ground covers, start with that. Look at specific soil needs. You know, certain plants may have a wide range of soil, so tolerates. Others might be really finicky where they need an acidic soil, for example, which is fairly common up here in the northern part of the state, but it's not very common in the southern part. And then look at, after that, does it fit in your scheme? You know, if you have a landscape plan, you know, will it fit with what already exists, or do you have a certain theme you want to put in if you're dealing with a herbaceous perennial border, whatever it might be? Look at maintenance needs. Look at how pest prone it is, if it is pest prone or disease susceptible. Does it need a lot of pruning? Does it need a lot of irrigation, fertilization, that kind of thing? So basically, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, do your homework. You know, when you're looking at plants, you know, if you see a plant in a catalog, it's always good to check another resource other than that catalog, because obviously, I mean, there's good information, like we talked about. There's some catalogs that are like almost like a manual you may have to purchase. But keep in mind that that particular nursery or that company is selling a product. So make sure, kind of go to a neutral site if you can, like Extension, for example. We have a lot of things on websites here on our site, and other states have similar, where you can look up a particular plant and maybe get an idea. Is it really a low maintenance plant, or is it really a good choice? Does it have any drawbacks? And that, again, make sure you have the identity of the plant. That's why I mentioned that, especially with herbaceous plants and trees and shrubs. So there's a lot of things that go there, but start with the fundamentals, you know, sun versus shade. What are you looking for? Do you want a big plant, a small plant, something to create a hedge or a privacy screen, something to fit in with already some plants that already exist there, all those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Roger in Minocqua, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling, Roger. What's on your mind?
I have two questions. Thanks for taking my call. The first one is, do you know of any particular seed catalogs that grow or are specialized in vegetables and trees specific for our northern climate?
Okay, and you had another one too?
The other question is, I read the plant vegetables say summer for a fall harvest. Well, our season is short. Should the summer be more is planted in spring so that I can get, say, a watermelon or a cantaloupe before the first frost?
Okay. So how early is planting season in the Minocqua area is basically, I think, what Roger's, that second question was about. And the first was, are there seed catalogs that specialize in seeds for northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, excellent questions. Actually, I'm right down the road from Minocqua. a couple things. What you look for, with the answer is yes. Most seed catalogs actually do cater to the, you know, the north, to the Midwest. And what you can specifically look for, like you mentioned, something like a watermelon or a pumpkin or a squash. A lot of times you have cultivars or varieties that will say they're ideal for northern gardens because they have a shorter time from planting to harvest. You know, that's always a drawback for us in the entire state of Wisconsin, but especially in the northern part of the state. You know, we have to wait till the threat of frost is over in, you know, late May, early June to plant. And then we, on the other end, we've got early frost coming in sometimes in September, which really shortens our growing season. So a couple steps to help with that. Look for varieties with intended for northern gardens, or a lot of times they'll give you that time interval from planting to harvest. So one variety might say 60 days, another one might say 80 days, one might say 100 days. You know, think about our growing season. You definitely want something that's under 100 days to make sure that you can get it in and get it harvested before the cold weather in the fall. And the other way around that to help is also with crops like watermelons, squash, plant them ahead of time, you know, start them as seeds and then put them in the garden as a transplant rather than direct seeding in the garden. That will help. The other thing that helps a lot when the time comes in planting, you can do some things to help kind of increase the heat around those plants with mulching, with row covers, that kind of thing to get a jump on the season. Not just here in northern Wisconsin, that's done statewide. That's been, you know, when I was in northern Illinois, that was a thing that a lot of commercial growers did with crops like tomatoes and cantaloupe to get a jump on the season. They put out row covers in the field, and that would get your harvest, you know, 10, 14 days earlier than if you didn't do that. So those kind of things. And then with herbaceous plants and woody plants, if you look in that direction, again, a lot of nurseries cater to the north. It's always good if you can to select plants that are locally grown or grown in a Midwest nursery rather than one down in Georgia or in the Carolinas or something, and make sure it's hardy. You know, we've got the hardiness zone map that's been updated recently.
What's Minocqua, 4A, 4B?
Yeah, most of 3 has disappeared. Oh, yeah. And, you know, again, the updated USDA hardiness zone map was done in 2023. They're looking at 30 years worth of climate data. So zone 4 for us, zone 5 for most of the southern part of the state. You got some zone 6 right along Lake Michigan. But look for hardiness with perennial plants. That's really not a concern with vegetable crops. But vegetable crops, you're more looking at how long does it take from planting to harvest.
Yeah. Well, Roger was asking about melons. What, are there good melons for the Minocqua area or that area, those zone 4 areas?
Sure. Yeah, again, get a jump on the season. I'd put them out as transplants rather than direct seed. Especially in a smaller home garden, it's very easy to put row covers out. You can buy them commercially. You can make them yourself. You can use the floating row covers that are kind of a fabric, or what actually works better are the clear plastic row covers where you put like some metal. You make like a hoop, mini hoop house essentially over your plants. And that'll, like I said, that'll give you a good 2-week head start on the season.
Yeah. What about if you're planting, let's say, the watermelon, use that as an example, when would you start that seed indoors?
You probably want to work backwards, you know, roughly a month or 6 weeks. So there again, for us, really most of the state, crops like watermelon, you know, the warm-loving crops, watermelon, cantaloupe, eggplant, you're not going to want to put those in until the very end of May or even the first week of June. So if you work backwards, sometimes the seed packet will help you with that, but you're probably looking at late April, sometime in April to start them indoors. You don't want to start them too early because then you got plants that are getting, you know, way too big and it's hard to transplant them and that kind of thing, but kind of work backwards. But generally you're looking.
Oop. We lost Bruce there for a second. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, we're talking with him about, well, we've been dealing a lot with seeds and catalogs, but you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. I think we might have Bruce back. Bruce, you're there?
Yeah, I saw something and it said I'd lost low or unstable internet or something. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
So you were talking about working backwards.
Yeah. So if you're looking at, you know, realistically, you're going to put those plants out the last week of May. You're probably going to start them in your house mid to late April. You know, kind of resist the temptation to plant them too early because then they get too big inside and they're more difficult to transplant. You know, sometimes you see people with tomatoes that already are flowering and they're still in the pot in the house or in the flat in the house, or you know, they got put in a little too early, or you had to wait too long because the weather just wouldn't cooperate.
Well, and then there's the other part, which is the first time I did transplants, I grew some tomato plants. And then I took them right straight out from inside to outside. And the next morning, they were all flat, lacking chlorophyll of any kind, and laying on the ground. Oh, man, I was so mad at myself. Oh, you need to kind of get them ready for that.
Yeah, right. You need to acclimate them or harden them off, because that's an excellent point, and that holds true with plants grown in a greenhouse as well. Indoors are in that perfect environment. They've got light, they've got humidity, and then you put them outside, it's drier, it's windy, and it's just a very harsh change. So you want to kind of gradually, you know, put them out for a couple hours, put them back in, do that for a few days so that they get hardened off so that you don't see that. Or if you can protect them, you know, put them in the ground and then put something over them to keep them out of the wind for and out of the sun for a couple of days, that can help.
Yeah. Heather in Prentice has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Heather.
Hi, I have a question. I have an apple tree that was planted on our property when we moved in, and I'm not sure what it is. I have asked a fellow at an orchard to try to identify it. He thought it was a red Cortland, but I have never eaten such a delicious apple. It's sweet, and it's like candy. My grandkids think it's just delicious. So I would really like to graft some of it, because the tree is kind of old, and I want to, you know, see if I can't keep it going. When is the right time to graft, to like take a cutting from that tree that and to actually attempt grafting? And what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's best to graft when they're dormant. So time-wise, you're at a good time. And generally what's done is people will take cuttings of the variety you want, like this tree. So you're going to take twig cuttings or, you know, branch cuttings, small twigs, try to get the newer growth on it. And then you need a rootstock. Now most apple rootstock, very commonly, they're actually crab apples that are, because they're hardy and they can also control the size of the plant that you grafted onto it. So what you might want to do is contact a orchard supply nursery. You may or probably won't find anything locally, but you know, Hilltop is one of them. And they may sell you a rootstock. They could make a suggestion, and then it's kind of hit or miss. You know, grafting is an art. Obviously, you want the scion or the apple that you like. It has to be compatible with the rootstock, and the orchard supply can help you with that. But essentially, you're going to graft them on, and then you can do that indoors, like in a greenhouse or in an unheated building. And then you need a little bit of time for that graft union to bind together. You have to get what's called callus tissue to grow to kind of seal it. And then you like to do all this before the growing season, and then put it outside and give it the opportunity to grow. So what I encourage you to do is check with some of the, you know, go online, get some of the orchard nursery supply type organization or outfits, nurseries, and then see if they can help you with some ideas on a good compatible rootstock, and you could order it from them. And then they may have some guidelines. You can go online and see. I'm sure there's things on YouTube on how to graft and that kind of thing. A lot of it's trial and error, but if you have a tree like that, you know, you can experiment with it. If you get a good hardy rootstock, your chances of success are pretty good.
Yeah, they are. I was trying to remember, there's a famous book about grafting, and I can't recall the author's name, but that's a ways back. But you're right. You can go online nowadays and probably find a pretty good video of doing it.
Yeah, and in fact, I think there's even some, I want to say it was either Penn State or Cornell. I just saw something the other day. I was just going through stuff online. They had a free online course on grafting and taking cuttings and that kind of thing. So you can look for that too, give you some ideas, and I'm sure there's videos as well, even if it's not a live course. But it's something to experiment with, and it's fun. You know, really the key thing with grafting is just whatever you decide to graft onto needs to be compatible. So like I said, if you're dealing with an apple, either another apple or a crab apple, and more commonly it's going to be a crab apple for the rootstock, and then you're matching, they'll show you what's called the cambium, which is the growth right under the bark. You have to match the cambium layer of the cutting part, which is the scion, to the rootstock and get that to bind together. And once you do, you've got you know, a successful graft. There are limitations because we used to talk about grafting when I, you know, in some of our courses, and people say, well, can I take a oak and graft it onto a birch? No, you can't. They're not, you know, they're way different as far as being related, but apples and crab apples, very compatible. You can graft those two together.
Brett in Southern Dane County, your turn now. Hi, Brett.
Great show, Larry. Happy New Year. We're going to miss you, man. We love you.
Thank you.
Yeah, down at the Capitol, they have a lot of graft and corruption, but I think that's different. So this is more of a macro question. I worked to help build a house out near Aspen, Colorado, that had a 900-square-foot greenhouse attached to it. They got heat from that, and they were able to raise bananas and a lot of their own food in that. Has anybody done a study on how much of our own food, and including fruits and vegetables, we could grow over the winter in Wisconsin, which is similar to Colorado, and cut our food imports from foreign countries that way? So,
yeah. Okay.
I think I'm sure there's information out there, but the biggest challenge with that is cost. You know, you could, in theory, make a greenhouse or construct a greenhouse facility and grow fruit crops, for example. But you have to look at how much is it going to cost to heat that. You know, that's always a stumbling block for the North. As a hobby, yeah, but if it's going to be a commercial venture that's going to sell that crop, the cost of that crop may be so high that it's just not realistic. So, plus, that was nothing here. But it's a great idea, and I'm certainly... There's a lot going on with, you know, things like hydroponics indoors, which you can do in the North. And you can, if you can figure out the economics of it, there's a lot of things, not necessarily bananas, but you can do things like, you know, a lot of vegetable crops, lettuce, you can grow strawberries. You can do a lot of things hydroponically in relatively condensed space where you can save on the cost, and it can be an economic venture. You know, there's some of that going on. So,
well, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of possibilities. It always comes down to, you know, what's the bottom line? Can we make it work to run a company, you know, and exist financially?
Well, once in a while on the show, I've had some, couple of guys from, or a guy from McFarland area, southern Wisconsin. They have a greenhouse and they sell. And they raise the crops in the wintertime. Well, they figured out a way to do it to make, you know, come out. And it's certainly being done right here in Wisconsin in some fashion, at least on the commercial scale.
It is. And the other thing that's happening is extending the season.
Yeah.
You know, by putting out you know, like hoop houses and doing things, row tunnels, that kind of thing, where you have almost like a mini greenhouse put out in the field. It's not necessarily heated, but you can extend the season. And some of those long crops, you have more time for harvest, or maybe you can get a double crop in, extend your season, and then have fresh produce available for a longer period of time than the traditional field way of growing it.
Brett, thanks again for calling. Good questions there. Nancy in Ridgeland, we'll go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
Say, you were talking about the grafting of the apple branches with that sweet apple tree, and it reminded me of what a friend of mine did many years ago in Orchard Ridge, right in Madison there, and they had, I don't know if it was originally a crab apple tree or an apple tree or just what it was, but they grafted branches of, I think, two or maybe three different kinds of apples on the same tree, and they also had pears on the same tree. And I thought that was pretty interesting that they could graft them in and have all these different kind of fruits, and they already had a solid rootstock in the ground. They didn't have to start from scratch.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling. Bruce, that sure can be done.
Yep, and again, you just follow the basic rule of if they're compatible, you can do it. And you can buy those. You'll see those in some of the catalogs where they'll have the 3-in-1, not just with apples. They'll do that with the crab apple where you can have white, pink, and red flowers on the same tree. You can do that with hibiscus. You can have multiple colors on the same plant. It's just following the same fundamentals. The only challenge, in addition to making sure they're compatible, every time you make a graft, that is a weaker structural part of the plant. So if you have, for example, an apple you've got a good rootstock and you have three different varieties or cultivars grafted onto that, there's three potential places where it could fail in an ice storm and wind and that kind of thing. So just a heads up on that. But yeah, you can be creative. You can do a lot of things.
Nancy, thank you. Yeah, appreciate the call. Ron in Manitowoc County, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ron.
Thanks, Larry. Your book on grafting that you were looking for the author may be a deer, Mr. Deer. Two questions. The first, for Bruce, is there any native shrub or tree in Wisconsin that could be used as rootstock for apple scions that would display a dwarfing ability? And the second question is, beech trees send up root sprouts from the roots that the root itself is around 1 inch in diameter or more, and there are no root hairs nearby. Is it possible to produce a tree from some of these sprouts, and how would you do it? Thank you.
Yeah. Couple of things there. We got.
Yeah, I think the first one there, looking for a native tree or shrub to graft on if you're dealing with apples, would be a native crab apple. Which would control the size and would be hardy and that type of thing. Like I said, a lot of apples already are grafted onto crab apple of some type. There again, it's going to be trial and error, but I don't, and maybe there's somebody doing it. I don't know anybody personally, but there could be that someone's already doing that. The other thing, the shoots coming out of the ground kind of thing, you want to be careful. And that, it brings up another excellent point. Remember, you're dealing with a scion, which is one variety or cultivar, the rootstock is another. So for example, if I graft an apple onto a crab apple and I've got this tree and I'm harvesting the fruit off the scion, which is the apple part that I grafted on, if I get a sucker coming out of the base and I let it develop, or sometimes if I lose the scion and I leave the root in the ground and I get new growth, I think it looks great. What happens when it finally flowers is I have a crab apple because that's the original rootstock. So if you're going to use vegetative material to graft, you want to be certain of its identity. And anything coming out of the ground, the risk is it's the rootstock, which is not, it's got the features of hardiness you want, maybe controlling the size of the plant you want, but it's not the fruit that you want.
Yeah.
And you may not realize that until 4 or 5 years later when it finally does flower and fruit. Then you realize, why aren't these apples getting any bigger than golf ball size? Well, it's because it was a crab apple. Yeah.
Okay. Ron, thanks again. Joni in Arena, your turn. Hi, Joni.
Yeah, good morning, Larry. I have a question about black knot. Every apple tree I have ever grown will develop black knot at one time or the other. How do I control it?
Black knot, yeah.
Yeah, black knot's a fungus. You get like the black, like corky growth on it. It's a genetic thing, and it goes back to resistance versus susceptibility. So, you know, all you can really do when you see it and is prune it out, and doing it in the dormant season is ideal to help prevent it spreading further. Sterilize your pruners, cut it out below, you know, go some inches below where you see that black corky growth into healthy tissue and cut that twig off and get rid of it. But some are more susceptible than others. So if you have it, and you take cuttings to graft off of that tree, you're going to keep that susceptibility, unfortunately. So look for black knot resistance. It's much more prevalent in plums. But yeah, it is a concern. You see it in the wild cherries, wild plums. But you'll see it now this time of year on the dormant plants. You can see that black corky kind of growth. It's tough to deal with. If a plant's really heavily infested, not much you can do. It may not totally kill it, but it's certainly going to disfigure it, and it's not, you just can't get rid of it.
There you go, Joni. Thank you so much for calling. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Monday at this time, Jesse LeGrue is going to be taking your tech questions. Then we'll talk about winter fire safety and finally take a look at the history of the mafia in Milwaukee. Looking forward to all of those. Right now, though, we're talking gardening with Bruce Bangenberg, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Jason in Greenbush, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I appreciate having me on, and I appreciate you and your years of service. Thank you for all that.
Thank you.
I wanted to share, got a little itch back in 2021 when it was COVID era, and wanted to continue my growing season throughout winter. So I needed to take down an old fence around the garden and shopped around for some free windows on Facebook and dug myself what's called a Wally Panini or in-ground greenhouse. And so dug it down about 8 feet or so and 6 feet wide, 20 feet long, and put it on a slightly north-facing hill, which wasn't the best, but it surprisingly worked. I was able to grow vegetables such as lettuce, spinach, and even a lemon tree I was able to grow in there and continue to grow.
Oh, very, very cool. And I was thinking about a friend of mine, Jason, Chuck Johnson. Charlie had gotten an old used boat hoist. And he, you know, the metal frame, it's a kind of an oval frame, and he put some visqueen or, you know, some sort of material over it and made his own greenhouse with that. And that extent, what that did was let him get started much earlier in the season and then extended it out on the other end. And, he had pretty darn good luck with it.
Yeah, that's a lot of things. Like I said, there's a lot of that being done now with even commercial vegetable growers that are, you know, experimenting with row tunnels out in the field. For that reason, you can start earlier, but especially extend the season in the fall.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Yeah. Jason,
I was going to say the key thing there, a lot of, you know, like you said, a lot of different things you can do with material that you might have available. You know, your basics are make sure you get enough light in there. And then the other issue you always run into is ventilation. You know, make sure you got a way to ventilate, because sometimes you don't think of it in Wisconsin, but it can get way too hot in those greenhouses that you make in addition to being too cold.
Good point. Jason, thanks again. Appreciate it. Crystal in Rhinelander, what's on your mind?
I am wondering what is happening to the lilacs in the area. In the summer, the leaves turn black and drop off. Is it a virus? Is it a fungus? And what can we do about it? Yeah. These are mainly the old-fashioned lilacs.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that most likely is Septoria, leaf spot or leaf blight, which is a fungus. And it's not a new disease, but it's relatively new as far as being a big problem. And it occurred two seasons ago. Kind of, you know, a lot of people kind of caught off guard because they hadn't seen it much, because we had just the right conditions and a lot of rainfall early in the year and the leaves get infected. So it is difficult to deal with. I believe you could use fungicides. They'd have to be put onto the plant as the leaves develop to try to help protect them. Try to increase air circulation if you can by pruning. Light penetration air circulation will help a little bit so the foliage dries out faster. But it's hard to say, you know, how that's going to, you know, long term, is that going to be a problem every year, or is that something that kind of sprung up and now maybe it'll fade away? Sometimes that happens. But that is a fungus problem.
Crystal, thank you very much. We had an email from Heidi in Poplar, asking if I will be making an appearance at the Garden Expo in a seminar or demo. She didn't see my name on the schedule. And I can say that I will indeed be at I always call it the Garden Expo, but it's really the official name is the Garden and Green Living Expo. Mm-hmm. And I will be hosting the Garden Talk radio show from there. And we're making a kind of a big deal out of it because it's my last time, you know, before I retire. And so I think they've even added some space. So that Friday of the Garden Expo, I will be broadcasting from 11 to 1. And I hope to have a little time afterwards. They've expanded the number of seating and all that, and hoping that a lot of folks will show up. And perhaps I'll have some time. Well, I'll take the time to talk to folks after the show's over and answer questions and that sort of thing. And we'll have a whole lot more about that as we get closer. When, I'm trying to remember the dates for it.
It's Valentine's weekend. 13,
yeah, it's always kind of Valentine's weekend. And actually, I think it officially opens at noon on Friday, but
yeah, Friday the 13th.
Yeah, except we get in early, so if you're going to the show, you'll be able to get in early to see the show in action. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing this for years with Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson, so we can cover a pretty broad range of topics when we get together, and of course answer people's questions who call in or email or those in the studio. So Heidi, I will indeed be there, and it'll be Friday of the Garden Expo, and we'll be broadcasting starting at 11. I'm sure you'll be able to get in early. We'll have the specifics on that coming up pretty quickly, if I'm not mistaken. I just did a little feature to promote the Garden and Green Living Expo about an hour ago, as a matter of fact. So you'll be hearing that. That was more general. The more specifics about my own presentation or appearance, we'll have that later on. What were the most questions? You know, we're kind of looking back here. What were the most questions you got? What were the topics that most often came up for you, Bruce?
For this past year?
Yeah.
The way we're kind of set up right now, most of the lawn questions come to me in our statewide network. So certainly crabgrass was the number one lawn question or problem of the 2025 season. Beyond that, you know, just a lot of, probably trees would be next, you know, tree problems in general, whether it be a fungal disease like apple scab, or if it's a cultural thing, you know, where a tree is too close to a building or it had construction damage, that kind of thing, or just odd weather kind of things that are coming up. But certainly in turfgrass, the number one thing this year was crabgrass.
Yeah. What are you looking forward to in this year? What do you think's gonna be the issue this year?
Who knows? It'll be. I mean, it's just. That's an excellent question, though, because you really can't predict that far ahead. You know, obviously, the two big things as the season unfolds is temperature and moisture. You know, what happens? So, do we get a cold, wet spring? Do we get a hot, dry spring? Do we get a really wet early summer? You know, that's going to have a huge influence on fungal diseases. And, you know, crabgrass, like I mentioned last year, what happened is, especially in the southern half of the state, we actually saw a lot of turf damage because we had no snow cover in the southern part of the state, and we had some pretty cold weather. So lawns are, you know, kind of damaged. They were slow coming out of the spring, and then we got warm weather and we got rain, and it was perfect. Crabgrass literally, you know, just almost overnight took over. So, you know, so what'll happen this year? It's hard to say. You know, we've got plenty of snow in the northern part of the state.
We got none here.
Yeah, years are gone. So will it set up again? You really don't know. But that's always tough. Makes it a challenge.
Bruce, it's always fun to have you with us. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to another visit. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Bruce Mangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Great to have him with us. We're going to continue with a look at our trees and shrubs here in the state and what we can do to help them through the winter. And, of course, take your questions. That's coming up. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk.